Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. We have with us again today Dr. Lumen Wing, a biochemist who got his PhD at Aberdeen University in Scotland and was a student under Dean Kenyon at San Francisco State University when Dr. Kenyon retracted his famous book, Biochemical Predestination. This was back in the late 1970s when Dr. Wing was just an undergraduate. And Dr. Wing went on to do work for about 15 years in biotechnology. He has a lot of background in biotechnology and toxicology and looking at biology from a systems perspective, trying to understand how drugs and various proteins in the body interact to find out whether or not a drug is going to be suitable for medical use. Is that about right, Dr. Wing?
Excellent summary. Yeah.
Okay. And Dr. Wing, as our listeners know, you're a signer of our Dissent from Darwinism list, and you're a Darwin skeptic. And we talked a little bit in the last podcast about why you were a Darwin skeptic and about how you think that systems biology really provides a superior approach to studying biology because basically it adopts an intelligent design analogous perspective where, as you said, systems biology assumes that you get these emergent properties that require lots of parts to be present all at once, the kind of biological assumptions that flow naturally out of an intelligent design paradigm and not from a Darwinian paradigm. I want to talk in this podcast a little bit more about the types of predictions that would come out of a intelligent design paradigm of biology, maybe you might even say intelligent design / systems biology perspective versus a Darwinian perspective. And specifically, I'd like to talk a little bit about junk DNA. Let me just ask you, now, have you kept up with the junk DNA literature? Whereas, you know, for instance, this last summer, a lot of papers were being produced and a lot of reports were being discussed that junk DNA was basically dead as a paradigm of genetics and cellular biology. What do you think about all of that?
Well, I find a number of the papers that have been discussed really allude to the fact that we do not know what junk DNA is. And as a matter of fact, even now, the whole concept of the word junk is being redefined because we're finding that numerous portions of junk DNA are actually supporting elements for genetic function. And so we're finding as even as transposons function, epigenetics, and so on, the way DNA interacts, we're finding it is a dynamic molecule that is not just a static gene producing only. It actually has three dimensions. It folds upon itself and it produces multiple gene functions that are certainly more complex than we ever imagined. So to relegate junk DNA as being dysfunctional or having no function simply means we don't know. So I believe that there's a lot more to junk DNA than ever imagined, and that's what the papers are telling us.
And let me ask you this question. I mean, obviously, we have had a lot of discussions here at Discovery Institute and evolutionnews.org about junk DNA, and many of the Darwinists have responded basically, in my view, by trying to rewrite history and claim that, well, it was the Darwinists who have all along been claiming that junk DNA wasn't really junk. But that seems to be a rewriting of history to me because, I mean, I agree there were some rogue Darwinian biologists who challenged the view that DNA was junk, but I think that their views didn't necessarily flow out of Darwinism. It flowed out of the observations of biology. And in fact, the truth of the matter is that the whole junk DNA paradigm was born and bred out of the Darwinian mindset that junk, that basically, you know, DNA is the result of random genetic mutations that create genetic garbage and that we would expect ourselves to be full of genetic garbage. It was a very Darwinian assumption that led to this paradigm. Do you agree with what I'm saying that, you know, junk DNA, the whole false junk DNA paradigm really was the love child of Darwinism and random chance?
Absolutely. One of the keys to understanding evolutionary descriptions from a Darwinian perspective is to realize that whenever there is a change in the paradigm based on empirical science, Darwinian evolution will seek to define it. So whether there, even if there isn't any function for junk DNA, there will be a Darwinian explanation. So we'll find that they will always be defining what is empirical. That's why we're going to be looking at intelligent design from the perspective of Darwinian, because simply we're seeing that life itself is an example of irreducible complexity. You can agree, I mean, life can't be predicted simply by analyzing chemicals and compounds and so on that make tissues and so on that aren't made of absolutely systems. There's no way you can analyze one single piece, hence junk DNA. It has to have some function, and you will find Darwinian definition as it's being revealed. The reality is that junk DNA was first described, as you said, by Darwinians, the Darwinian methodologies, because it was simply an accumulation of leftover DNA from our ancestors. The reality is that we don't know how it's functioning because it is a dynamic molecule. The human genome, as we're finding, is loaded with ways in which genes are expressed by multiple pieces of DNA.
You know, now, actually, that junk DNA has basically been proven to be a bad description of the way our DNA works, Darwinists are now predicting a new concept of junk RNA, where a lot of DNA is being transcribed into RNA, but it's still just floating around in the cell doing nothing. Would you care to make any predictions about what will come of the new junk RNA paradigm that's coming out of Darwinism?
I find that fascinating that there even concept of junk RNA exists, simply because when there's gene expression, it's obviously for the purpose of transcription factors that are responsible for signing this gene and a duty within the cell. So because we don't know what the function of that transcript is at this point, doesn't mean that it's junk. Hence, the concept of junk will always be redefined as we start to get further clarification of its purpose. Finding within the systems itself that there's going to be a reason for that piece of RNA.
Let's switch topics here a little bit about to another Darwinian argument that I think you might take some issue with. When I attended the Dover trial, and I actually listened to Ken Miller's testimony there, Dr. Wing, I heard him argue about the blood clotting cascade, which ID proponents obviously have argued is an example of irreducible complexity. And Dr. Miller argued during the Dover trial that it was not irreducibly complex. And his basic reasoning was that because certain species, such as I believe he said, dolphins and whales and maybe some fish species, have a blood clotting cascade that uses a couple fewer proteins than, say, the human blood clotting cascade does, that therefore the human blood clotting cascade is not irreducibly complex. And this seemed like an interesting but not exactly complete argument to me, but it actually carried the day, and Judge Jones even adopted basically Ken Miller's position in his Kitzmiller ruling. Now, you study the blood clotting cascade quite a bit. As a matter of fact, I understand that you have even studied it in some of your doctoral work. Is that right?
That's correct. Exactly.
And your what do you think of that argument?
Well, I think it's fascinating that it would actually hold any water in the final testimony, because if you look at the different species, the phylogenetic tree would show or would suggest that there's going to be variations, but certainly not negations of proteins that are going to make the human blood clotting cascade a greater complexity than the lower species. It simply means that there's an efficiency factor, and the human's efficiency factor is extremely high related to other species. So that argument it's fascinating that would hold any kind of credence in court. I find it fascinating, and I still can't believe that actually went through.
Just on a logical level, though, can you explain to our listeners why is it true that the fact that one system uses two fewer proteins than another system uses to do a given function does not mean that the systems are therefore not irreducibly complex?
Well, because irreducible complexity by itself, by its definition, implies that each of these proteins are in a specific place at a specific time to produce a single function. All of them produce a clot. And even in humans, we find certain proteins may not be necessary, but it doesn't mean that it's any less efficient. That's the key, is that we're talking about an efficiency concept, not irreducible complexity by itself.
Okay. So it really doesn't have anything to do with irreducible complexity, the fact that, you know, the number of parts that you're using or something along those lines.
Exactly. When you have a deleterious deficiency like factor VIII, then you have clotting disorders. But other than that, it simply doesn't have anything to do with irreducible complexity at all. It simply has to do with efficiency.
Very interesting. Well, let's move to one final topic here. And I know that you are very interested also in bioethics. Mm-hmm. And you have also done some work, I believe, on personalized medicine and the implications that intelligent design versus Darwinism might have for personalized medicine due to your work in biotechnology. Can you explain to our listeners, what is personalized medicine?
Well, it's a fascinating field, and it has its roots in systems biology and in the sort of the whole arena of what are called genomics. Understanding, just as we were talking a minute ago, about how DNA is a very dynamic molecule. And we talk about genomics, we talk about how the human genome really is a very dynamic molecule as far as how it responds. And as we're understanding more and more about how drugs affect the genome, we're seeing that certain genes are either functional based on the exposure to a drug or not functional. So in the very near future, we're going to find ourselves in a medical office and a blood sample will be taken from us and we will have a drug exposure in vitro in a dish, and they'll see if your genes are upregulated or not based on exposure of a given drug. And on that drug exposure, if there is a specific, like your liver enzymes are upregulated, it will say that you can properly metabolize this drug, and hence it can be given to you. Off-label drugs will ultimately can be used for you specifically. And so you will have more of a diagnostic-driven, specifically individuated drug dosing now, much more so than the therapeutic-driven of drugs today, in which the blockbuster drugs are useful to mankind. And that era is coming to an end because of how pharmacogenomics, based on systems biology and, if you will, intelligent design, has given us now a new tool on how to present medicine to mankind. It's fascinating, and it's certainly coming right down the pike as I speak. There's a company called Decode, and also one called 23andMe, two big companies that are promoting this and really looking at one specific issue within the genome. And every human being has a unique set of what are called SNPs. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I've heard of that.
SNPs, okay. And that's really what is the fingerprint of your genome. Basically, a SNP stands for single nucleotide polymorphism. Now, however sophisticated that is, it simply means that of the 3 billion base pairs that make up a human genome, every single one of those 3 billion, you can have a variation. Now, if that variation of that A, T, G, and C base pair occurs within a functional region, that means a place where a gene is that produces the RNA, that produces the protein, you could either have a variation of that protein or not have that protein function at all, which would mean that if it occurs, let's say, at a region of a liver enzyme that could be produced. If it isn't produced, you will not be able to metabolize that drug, and hence you will not be able to have that drug given to you at all. And that would be a great way for a physician to know how to give you this drug specifically based on your genome and not by his trial and error medicine that's currently present in our medicine today. So we're finding that change in medical practice is really coming about based on genomics and pharmacogenomics, and hence personalized medicine.
And how does intelligent design play into this whole issue?
Intelligent design, if you will, along with systems biology, has its roots in the fact that all of the genome of the human being is functional, and it's all dependent on itself. All of them need to be present at the same time, and hence, for a gene to be functional, it has to have a transcription factor, which is a protein that turns on a specific gene at a very specific time. And all of these proteins have to function together in order to present this given protein in response to a given drug. So again, you cannot expect Darwinian concepts to be useful at all in this, because all of these proteins are absolutely dependent on a static system that doesn't change. Darwinian evolution or genetic principles assume that there is a constant change, a constant evolving process. You don't see that. And all of this is based on a static system.
Okay. So the very assumption that we can treat certain diseases almost implicates limits to genetic change. Would you say that?
Absolutely.
Wow. Very, very interesting. Well, Dr. Lumen Wing, this has been a very enlightening series of three interviews now We thank you for your work and for signing our Dissent from Darwinism list and for standing up and being a proponent of academic freedom for scientists who support intelligent design.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else you'd like to add? Maybe some advice for a young scientist who's in a position like you once were, where you were trying to decide whether you should, you know, speak out and question evolution in the classroom or play it safe and get your degree. What advice would you give to a student who was in a position like you were when you were an undergraduate, facing a biology department that was very hostile to students and faculty that are skeptical of evolution?
I think one of the greatest things that a student could do today is to stay in the program and continue to be excellent in their science and to pursue it with the perspective of, yes, intelligent design, and yes, demonstrate it in the experiments, because they truly reveal it in every experiment you do.
That sounds like really good advice. Thank you so much, Dr. Wing. We really appreciate your time.
Certainly.
This is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast signing off. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Finn. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.